I'm John Kroll. April is National Poetry Month. Today, in this special recorded No Limits, we will mark the occasion by talking with Hoosier poets Norbert Kropp, Manon Voice, Devin Ginn, and Wendy Vergose about their work, and we'll ask them to read their poetry. Because this is a recorded No Limits, we won't be able to take questions or comments by phone, by email, or through social media. But we hope you enjoy the conversation and the poetry. Now, this news. Welcome to this special recorded No Limits. We're going to be talking with some of Indiana's poets. April is National Poetry Month, and we always mark the occasion by doing a show on poetry. We're fortunate to have with us today poets Norbert Kropp. Did I pronounce that right, Norbert?
Perfect.
Got it right? Okay. Devin Ginn, Manon Voice, and Wendy Vergose. Welcome to all of you.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
And because this is a recorded program, that means we're not able to take calls, emails, or questions or comments via social media. But we hope you enjoy the conversation. More than that, we hope you enjoy the poetry as we talk. So I'm going to start with Manon here. You talk a little bit. It's a simple question, and I'm going to take it around the horn here. But why are you a poet? With a complex answer, I suspect. Not an easy answer.
Yeah. I'm a poet because poetry, I feel like, birthed me. Poetry began when I discovered it at a very young age, in first or second grade, by one of my dear teachers named Miss Eigel. I was fascinated with words, and poetry felt like, to me, sort of like this safe place. To be in this safe place to go in. It was another world. And so it was a world that I went in to be safe and then to hide. And then it also became a world that I build a bridge out of hiding, that I wrote myself into being and into becoming. And I continue to do that. And so poetry has been, sort of the second salvation for me, this lifeline. Even if I didn't write poetry, I would still love it. I've been reading poetry all of my life, and I love poets across time and space. And it seems to me to be the magic of how I understand myself, how I understand the world, how I understand the art of living. And so I couldn't imagine myself without poetry. And so I'm just very fortunate to be able to be a vessel of it.
Wendy, same question. Why are you a poet?
Very similar. I mean, that was beautifully stated. Thank you. I started writing when I was 9. I remember the first poem I wrote. And then I ended up becoming a teacher and rediscovered my passion for poetry when I was asking my sophomore high school class to write a poem. And I could do everything I was asking them to do. I could analyze Shakespeare. I could write an essay. By this time, I realized what a literary poem was. Not the sing-song, it's your birthday or Mother's Day poem that I had written when I was a girl. And so I felt it wasn't fair for me to ask my students to do something that I could not do, that I didn't understand from the inside out. And so I wrote with them. And I'll never forget Tim Sperling, the student in the class. I still remember his name. We read poems, and I read mine out loud to the class. And Tim said, "That's a real poem." And I just thought, wow, like, I can't not do this now. Like, this is exciting. So I ended up in a workshop at the Poetry Center of the Art Institute of Chicago. And from there, just my trajectory, I just kept having the opportunity to study with different people. Poetry saved my life mm-hmm. as well, which I think you'll probably hear in the poems that I read. I can't not write. Mm-hmm. I'm not one of those get up at 4 a.m. and write every day. I write when I'm moved to write, mm-hmm. which is often mm-hmm. And necessary.
Mm. Norbert, same question.
I began to write poetry at the age of 26 after I finished my PhD. I had fallen in love with poetry and loved to read it and to teach it. And I had thought that I wanted to write it, and it didn't happen. And I sort of gave up on it happening, deciding I would just be the best teacher of poetry I could become. And I told a friend at St. Joe's College, I bet I'd write if I moved east, thinking I'd have something worthwhile, something sophisticated to write about. I moved to the East Coast, and I did start to write, but my reasons were wrong. What did I write about? My Indiana German heritage, my mm-hmm. rural background, my parents, my family history, all that sort of thing. And it was a great vehicle for exploring heritage. Germans in America didn't really like to be even think of themselves as German after the mm-hmm. first two world wars off. And then German heritage, I mean, the mm-hmm. names were changed at streets and all that sort of thing. And German was outlawed in Indiana in 1918. But it came pretty quickly then as I was moved to the East Coast to begin teaching. I married a woman from Louisiana who finished. We met at Notre Dame. We got married there, and we got both got jobs on Long Island. And we started to teach there. And it was really wonderful for this to happen. And it never has let up ever since then. It's been 50 years now, and it's been just magnificent. I love it, every second of it.
Devin.
So I fell in love with poetry in a non-traditional manner. I'm sure folks remember HBO's Deaf Poetry, mm-hmm. where you see the bravado and the amazingness mm-hmm. of the performances from those artists. And it always felt like something that I couldn't do. And it wasn't until I had teachers just kind of pour into me and support me and tell me that, you know, what you're writing is worthy of being read on a page. But what does that look like when you take it to a stage? Mm-hmm. And I always appreciate the idea of sort of mastering the English language mm-hmm. and then dismantling it through poetry mm-hmm. to create artwork.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, I like that.
Yeah, that was good.
Let me put that on a shirt. No. and it's just kind of been something that's always been a part of my life, and it's something that I've always loved to do. And being a thespian, the teachers who reared me through theater, they said, you know, the stuff that you write is beautiful. What happens when you take it to the stage? How can you let that translate?
So, Devin, I think we've gotten to a point where we ought to hear some poetry here. I'm going to start with you and ask everyone to kind of go around the horn and share a short poem with us to get us started, and if you want to set it up or do a background or just go in and let the poem stand by itself.
Sure thing.
It's your choice.
I've always had an issue with prefacing poetry, even though I preach to my students and the people that I write with. No, never preface your work, so I'll avoid doing that. This piece is titled Threatened with Extinction. America, is the unclipped wick making a mockery of the glass holding its wax while the world giggles at our luck? It's the glimpse of twilight cast from the depths of our flesh, allowing us to breathe in a fate we hastily accept. And the hollow spaces where they design the tools of the damned feel too much like home, too much like good intentions. Bodies existing in the margins stomach the weight of the great American parable, fearful to rouse persons at rest. How we wish to navigate such precarious terrain, never administered that atlas y'all traverse rivers with. Bellies full from hunger, devoid of hope, still frolic to the tune of tomorrow and with love. The palms and the soles of the feet lose their familiar grip with comfort. Sprinklings of generational calamity paint portraits the world abhors and fails to critique in the appropriate light, bathed the darkest of demons in holy water with the intent to air dry the secrets we've bleached and bleached and bleached with the impurities rooted too deep, so we scrub our skin raw to clean our confusion, praying that the scabs we yield will harden all over and fall quick enough to show off the wings we pray will appear gallant. I've got genuine love for all beings, too, forced to inhabit this hostile environment. And we've the nerve to call such a space home. And we've the nerve to bear backbone sans brevity, forced to memorize a script written in a foreign tongue on the hunt for some magic held hostage in America's knuckle. With love, the mind has the potential to quiet its natural ebb and flow of traffic and chaos. With love, our bodies have the potential to hyperfocus on the pulse of souls we've never met. So if this oxygen too occupies those ribs, I've got genuine love in these bones for the likes of you.
Wow.
So
gorgeous.
Yeah. And I've got to do this for the listeners here. A couple of things that struck me with that. One, Devin, you weren't reading the poem. You had you had memorized it, so you weren't operating from a text. But two, one can tell your acting or performance background there. Does the poem for you, you know, is it still alive when it's just on the page, or is it an experience that screams to be performed, that it has to be an oral experience?
So I definitely like both perspectives. I feel from a literary perspective, work should stand alone on a page, regardless of whether it's being performed or not. And, you know, that's a matter of formatting and content, et cetera. But I'm a ham. Let's just be honest. I love to create my own content and then create a story that people can feel. And I like to get visceral reactions. And honestly, that's more of a tame poem. It's one of the shorter ones that I've got. So.
Yeah.
Okay, Norbert, could you share something with us?
Sure. I'm going to read a poem called Singing Indiana Birdsong to my grandson from a new book of poems about this little guy. We adopted our children as infants from Bogota, Colombia, and our daughter is now 38, and she's living in Germany because she went back to Germany where we had lived twice on Fulbright grants. And she went to a German school. She was finishing a master's in German at Portland State, and she worked in a bar, being a bartender and also serving food, cooking, and she fell in love with a German from my ancestral region of Franconia. Yeah. They got married, and this is the little grandson. And this is going over there when he was 1 month old and meeting him for the first time and holding him, and this is what I decided to do. He is tired and cranky and fussy, and I decide to speak to him in the language of song. Not just because he is Colombian and German and American, and some part of him may recognize an ancestral song, I decide to sing the songs of Indiana birds to him here in southern Germany. I should call up and sing a song I know. I start with a hoo, hoo, hoo of mourning doves, and he stops fussing and turns his eyes and ears towards me. He keeps looking at me as if my music sounds familiar, and he wonders how I know it and can give it back to him. So I go with another song I know well, the Bob, Bob White of the quail I also remember from my Midwestern childhood. His eyes open wider, as if he realizes I have even greater powers than he knew. Every note of either song makes him quieter and calmer and brings him nearer to me as I enter deeper into the mystery and miracle he is.
Mm. Beautiful.
Is that family then one of the themes that you like to explore the most,
yes,
with your poetry?
Yes, family history is very important, family relationships, and so that's you see it working there. And also, I have worked with musicians combining poetry and jazz with Monica Herzig of IU and our wonderful Indiana bluesman Gordon Bonham combining poetry and blues with him. So he backed me on this at the Whitcomb, James Whitcomb Riley Memorial Home in their wonderful visitor center. As I recited this, he played actually it was a Neil Young old-time waltz that
nice.
Was perfect backing. Mm-hmm. You can hear that on my website.
Go ahead and give the URL, Norbert.
It's www.kropfpoetry.com. That's K-R-A-P-F poetry.
If you are just joining us, April is National Poetry Month, and we're marking the occasion by talking with four of Indiana's poets in this special recorded No Limits. We just heard from Norbert Kropf and Devin Ginn, poems from them. When we come back, we're going to hear from Manon Voice and Wendy Vergose, their poems as well. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls or emails or allow you to join the conversation through social media, but we hope you are enjoying the conversation. More important than that, we hope that you are appreciating and enjoying the poetry. I am John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to this special recorded No Limits when we are talking with four Indiana poets to mark National Poetry Month here on No Limits. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take calls, emails, or messages via social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation. We hope you're enjoying the poetry. My guests are Norbert Kropf, Devin Ginn, Manon Voice, and Wendy Vergose. Before we went to the break, we heard two wonderful poems
yes.
and performances from Devin and Norbert. We're going to start now with Wendy. And again, same choice. If you want to set up the poem, you can. If not, you can just dive right into
Thank
it.
Thank you. I'm not going to set this one up. I'm going to let this one speak for itself. And I want to give a shout out to my students at Marion University who helped me choose this one and said, don't set it up, just read it. So, all right. This is called His First Wife, and it has an epigraph from Elizabeth Bishop's poem, The Fish. The epigraph reads, "And victory filled up the little rented boat." He'd caught her like a fish. That's how he told it when asked how they met. "I had to get it right just once," he'd say. "I got it right with my first wife." As he spoke, he would demonstrate precisely how he played the catch. Right hand flung behind right shoulder, left hand in front of his face as he tipped back and cast the make-believe line which had perfectly snagged her. Next, right hand drew quick small circles and both hands glided toward his jaw as he reeled her in deliberately. She listened to his story and wondered, as they were still married, at his use of the phrase, first wife, though he said it always with a chuckle. One day his words formed a hook in her mouth. She tasted blood, so she cut the line and lived.
Ooh.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, we've got to ask that, you know, there is a rhythm to that
mm-hmm.
at the beginning,
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, and I hate to use kind of violent imagery, but I always tell my students when we're talking about writing,
mm-hmm.
often it's the short sentence or the short phrase that
yes.
carries the power. It's
mm-hmm.
like when you're boxing, it's the short punch that's going to do the damage.
Mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. You know, where did that last line come from?
So I was married to an abusive man for 20 years,
mm-hmm.
and he really did tell this story again and again. This poem is really about the power of shame and of being blinded to the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Getting personal here for a moment, because my poetry essentially is memoir,
mm-hmm.
I was raped at 15.
Mm-hmm.
So that covered me in shame and made me blind to the fact that I had married a man who saw me as something he just, you know,
yeah.
could catch.
Mm-hmm.
So I filed for divorce 10 years ago this month. And then I went over the summer to the Napa Valley Writers Conference and studied with inaugural poet Elizabeth Alexander. I was devastated at the time because it was the first time I'd been away from my children for so long. And we had to do 5 poems in 5 days. It's a conference you go to generate. Yeah. So the pressure was on. And I don't know, I just I'm really proud, actually, of the one day his words formed a hook in her mouth.
Oh. Yeah.
She tasted blood. You know, where did that come from? I just don't know, except that this really happened. And somehow I had this epiphany that I was the fish.
Was that the way you saw it when you were, you know, literally when you were living the experience?
No.
No?
No.
Okay.
No.
Isn't that the way it happens? Sometimes the best lines come from we don't know where they
are. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Deep down somewhere in the psyche. Yeah.
My manuscript, my book will be published in fall of 19. It's coming out, and it chronicles a woman's experience of surviving trauma, and it's called The Unbinding. So this is literally my writing, and my children saved my life. This was a way to unbind from that trauma, and this is an early manifestation of that unbinding. This is the very last poem in the manuscript, and the last section of the book is called Cut the Line and Live. And what I want listeners to know is if they taste blood in their mouths, they can cut the line, and they can live. They are not alone.
We're going to come back to this and talk, because I want to bring Manon into this readers and writers circle right now and share her work. Same thing. Would you like to set up the poem or have it stand by itself?
And actually, thank you so much, because I think this is probably a good segue as well. And so this poem that I'm going to read is called Bent in the Light, and it's also autobiographical and sort of based on, it's about some trauma that I faced. I'm fascinated with the body as not just being this functional apparatus, you know, like by which we sort of drive our cars and eat food and go for walks, but also this container that holds experiences and that holds energy and that holds memories. Mm-hmm. And so this poem is sort of written as I was coming into, I say, the life of my body. And this is called Bent in the Light. A wise woman told me that whatever comes, comes from love, but on the way through gets bent in the light, and thus named the inarticulateness I could feel in those prison moments, my legs hounded to the grass, thrown on my ribs, the weight of glory, of boys, of hormones, of stricture, of Christ, of belts, the scream of vexing to rescue my underwear from witness, that pressure distilled into silence that fell back into my chest. Today, I tried again to say no, but the silken net of invisibility is a clever jester. She went off capering a smirk, delighting a cloud, blowing heads of dandelions, and remembering anything, anything besides herself. Look, it's been 20 years or so in the mine, but my limbs never did raise the dead. Ah, I do remember. It was broad daylight, my years not yet under my belt, the front yard of a Seventh-day Adventist father also squeezing sun drops from his son, wrestling me into moonshine, shadow, and sundown ground. This shroud I visit often, engraved day, slipping back into the hollows of bolted thighs, squirming under the blindness to see if this time we might turn a trick of darkness.
Mm-hmm. So, and I think I'm going to use this to talk, because it's clear, you know, poetry, for it to work and for it to be the kind of communal, It is an incredibly intimate form of expression that is there. And I want to talk a bit, I think all of you at in one way or another, either said or alluded to the idea that poetry saved your life. Mm-hmm. I want us to explore that a little bit in the context of the poems that you just read. Manon, I'm going to start with you first on that, because clearly that, you know, and I'll reframe the question ever so slightly and say there are clearly some things that are born of tremendous pain for you in that. Mm-hmm. In that, is poetry a safe way to release some of that? Because the other, you know, the other way to think of that is if there's a lot of anger in that poem that, you know, absent poetry, would you be up in a clock tower with a rifle in your hand, perhaps, or something like that?
Yeah, I think, I mean, absolutely, poetry has saved my life. I've been writing, you know, for over 20 years. And so I was literally just a child writing poetry. And you know, and like I said, it was that safe place for me, and it still is. It still is that safe place. You know, they say that there is something just even about the process of writing, of moving memory through the body, through the hand, mm-hmm. and out on paper, and that actually something energetically moves and happens when we start to write. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, this has sort of been, you know, documented, you know, like by scientists and by like energy workers. And I do very much believe that. And I've experienced that in my own life, in my own experiences. Poetry seems to be this place where it becomes then okay to be angry, mm-hmm. and okay to be mm-hmm. sad,
and it's
okay
healing too, isn't
yeah you know, like when I can't go outside and scream at the top of my lungs, you know, or, you know, mm-hmm. do something else because I might be, you know, in a mental like institution, poetry says it's okay for you to actually come here
and speak the truth.
And just speak the truth. Be just who you are. Like poetry says, come as you are. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Come as you mm-hmm. are. And that's why it's so raw. It's so intimate. Like when you hear a poet speaking, you know, and some of it, you know, people may be sort of put off by or take, you know, or take offensively. But it literally is this place that poets go to just be who they are, to come mm-hmm. who they are, raw and mm-hmm. naked.
And to figure out who they are.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I mean, that always been that for me.
Devin, I'm going to pull you in because one of the things, again, because the people who are listening to this weren't in the studio and couldn't see it. But before you started to recite your poem, I mean, the image that stuck in my head of where you were going was almost like you were moving into a trance of some kind, going to some some place, you know, where you were visiting that experience or finding that voice. Mm-hmm. You know, is that performance quality? Does it allow you to give voice to things that you would be uncomfortable doing mm-hmm. otherwise?
Absolutely. You know, I think the performance aspect of it is both transformative and healing too for me, because when I have a script and when it's somebody else's work, I kind of dive into that character mm-hmm. and that person. And when it's your own work, it looks completely different, and it's got this really cool therapeutic quality that, without the performance aspect of it, although I think the poem stands, mm-hmm. it's just something that feels so good and authentic, just to kind of lay it all on the table and take people to that place that you're at when you're reciting the work, you know.
Wendy, go ahead. Norbert, did you want to jump in and say something?
I just wanted to say that the book I read that first poem from is called The Return of Sunshine, about our grandson. But before that, I wrote two books on surviving child abuse by a priest, and was working on a third work, a play that's going to be produced in June. But uh, it you know, it's very healing. And I had to wait 50 years before. It was 50 years after the abuse ended that I decided to write about it.
Wow.
And to speak for my
my
experience and for my fellow survivors. And that's very gratifying, you know.
Wow.
But the little grandson is kind of healing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
He's my healer.
Yeah.
He's my bringer of light, as I call him.
Yeah.
Well, and Wendy, I was struck when you were talking about your poem and how you came to terms with your experience that it was really through poetry that you could only make some kind of sense of
absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. That's absolutely true. And so I, similar to Norbert, I was raped at 15 and didn't realize it until I was 42 years old through a conversation with a friend. Nobody talked about rape in 1981. So that was how my writing, you know, the trauma started entering. And once I healed with my therapist from that rape, through a lot of writing, by the way, I do the same process. It's safe. Mm-hmm. It's one of the few places I can actually process and face. I healed from the rape and within a few months was filing for divorce because I could see what I hadn't seen. You know, people now, my poetry was Me Too before there was a Me Too.
Mm-hmm.
And people wonder, well, why don't victims speak up? If she was raped at 15, well, you're so covered in shame, you literally cannot see the truth. Mm-hmm. And if you go through my manuscript, what you see is you see this evolution of a woman shifting from victim to realizing what's going on, recognizing as well that the children are the light. My children saved me. That's in my poetry. That's you know where that really came forth. And then to the shift, there's a shift that happens in people like me, I hope, for those who have survived. You shift from victim to survivor. And that's key.
Yeah.
If you are just joining us, we are talking about poetry in honor of American National Poetry Month here on No Limits Today. It's a recorded program, so we're not taking calls or questions by email or social media. Hope you're enjoying the conversation, though. As I was listening to all of you, and we've only got a few minutes in this segment left, so I'm going to ask everyone to be as concise as possible in your answer. I was thinking, I just finished a magazine piece on the 50th anniversary of publication of Slaughterhouse-Five. Mm-hmm. And Kurt Vonnegut, who wrote the book, obviously, son, said that that Kurt was suffered from PTSD and that really his writing was a way of coping with that and dealing and getting it out in a therapeutic way. And he said he would have drank himself to death if he hadn't been able to write.
True. Yeah.
So I'm going to ask real quickly, if you couldn't write poetry, what would have happened to you?
Oh,
Jesus. I'll start with Norbert first.
I'm not really sure. I grew up in a town where there was a lot of drinking. And after the abuse happened and I graduated from high school and went to college and came back, I really drank a lot. Mm. It is because I was right at almost the scene of the crime that went on when I was sixth, seventh, and eighth grade.
Yeah.
I knew I had to get out of town.
Wendy?
I've done my share of self-medicating through drinking, so I do understand that, but I don't think I would have survived. I honestly believe that I would have... I have a poem called My Suicide Poem, and in it you can see how one of my children's faces pulls the driver back from heading into traffic.
Wow.
You know, you can see that the writing literally saved my life. I don't know how I would. Yeah. I can't answer that. Yeah. I don't know that I would be here, literally.
Yeah.
Manon.
Yeah, I think that's also true for me. The word that came to me was just sort of, you know, that words sort of, you know, forced me out of them, right? And they said, okay, you have to come out. Mm-hmm. You have to, you know, speak your truth. And I think without words, I would have been still living just in the shadows and not really this person here.
Devin, you got the last word, but you've only got about 20 seconds to deliver.
Well, honestly, who would I be without poetry, right? I'm very grateful to have a wonderful support system who, in spite of the issues that I've had growing up, they've kept me sane. And it's the introduction of poetry from my network that's put me in the place that I am now.
Mm-hmm.
We are talking about poetry in honor of National Poetry Month today on No Limits with the poets Norbert Krapf, Devin Ginn, Manon Voice, and Wendy Vergoes. Because this is a recorded program, we're not able to take your questions or comments by phone, email, or social media, but we hope you're enjoying the conversation and, more important, the poetry. I'm John Krall. You're listening to No Limits. Please, stay with us. Welcome back to this special recorded No Limits, where we're talking with four Indiana poets in honor of National Poetry Month. They are Norbert Krapf, Devin Ginn, Manon Voice, and Wendy Vergoes. I'm going to start with Wendy. I'm going to ask you just to read a poem again. You can set it up or choose not to.
Okay. This one I am going to set up very briefly. There's a Costco flyer that comes every month, and it has these garage racks that can hang overhead or be on the wall. And every time I saw that flyer with those racks, it triggered my trauma. And so I decided that I would write about that. And so here we go. This poem is called Stuff. Safe Racks Overhead Garage Storage Combo Kit. 2 4x8-foot ceiling racks stuffed with coolers, camping equipment, ski boots, kids' clothes, Lincoln Logs, Tinker Toys. Boxes of photos, grad school papers, suitcases, my wedding dress. Confident our daughter would wear it one day. Boxed by professional dry cleaners, then encased in a muslin drawstring bag to preserve it for years to come. I sit in the driver's seat, car parked under the safe racks in our tiny garage, a two-story ladder bungee-corded to the wall beside me, barely enough room to get out. I gaze in front of me. Wall shelves. 5 rows of wall shelves filled with basketballs, soccer balls, frisbees, rollerblades, hiking bowls, bicycle pumps, helmets, tennis balls, toilet paper, paper towels, laundry soap, garage bags, lawn and leaves, extra towels, old sheets, Sterilite bins jammed with Christmas ornaments, wrapping paper, ribbon, Sterilite bins stuffed with Halloween decorations, plastic orange and black pumpkins, a fake glow-in-the-dark headstone on a shelf nearby. I can't leave him, I think. We have too much stuff. We could never untangle.
Wow.
So, I'm noticing, admittedly, you've only read two of your poems here. But it does strike me there is a theme of confinement.
Yes.
That runs through all of this. And we've talked about poetry to some degree as revelation.
Mm-hmm.
What parts of your poem surprise you?
So you mentioned Kurt Vonnegut's son and trauma. My best poem is actually titled 309.81, The Unbinding. And that's where the title of my book comes from. 309.81 is the DSMV diagnosis for PTSD. And what surprises me about my poetry is the way that even amidst the darkness, bits of hope come out. So in this very long poem about unbinding from trauma that I wrote actually in a program that Sandy Sasso produced, bringing together all different kinds of artists, the poem is very dark, and yet suddenly chickadees and a dogwood tree blossoming appeared in the poem. And I didn't deliberately put them in. I was telling the story I needed to tell. It's a speaker who's a survivor of domestic violence speaking with Isaac. The Binding of Isaac was the impetus for this poem. So what surprises me, and just what makes me say that I have hope, I have a future. After all these years of struggle and darkness and trauma, what surprises me is that hope that shines through. I know that sounds cliche, that shines through, but, you know, I didn't intentionally put it in. And so it's like what you said about you write because it just comes and comes. And
it's like a hook at the end of the other poem.
Yeah.
Norbert, I'm going to ask you to share something as well, if you would.
Okay, I'm going to read it. A poem from a book that brought Wendy and me together as friends, and we worked together. Catholic Boy Blues, that book I mentioned about surviving child abuse, after 50 years, I started to write the poems, and almost unbelievably, 325 poems came in a 12-month period, a night and day almost. Mm-hmm. It was volcanic. But this is not one of the gritty, dark poems of, giving details of the abuse itself. This is a sort of a pausing poem addressed to my fellow survivors. It's called mm-hmm. This Is Not mm-hmm. the End. Mm-hmm. And it's so wonderful, as ironic as this sounds, to tell even your darkest stories. This is not the end. Once upon a time, there was a priest who took advantage of young boys, deceived their parents, and covered his tracks. But after the boys became men and could no longer keep quiet, some of them told the bishop and insisted that if he did not speak out, the whole sad story would explode and many people would be hurt. The bishop spoke. Other boys who were now fathers and grandfathers gathered the strength to tell their story, but some still could not take the step. One day they may be able to make their move and have their say. You, readers out there, may even know who they are. Nobody in any of these stories, wherever they take place, will live happily ever after. But if people can summon what it takes to tell the truth, they can live together and help others find their voice. One voice singing by itself can sound awfully small, but several voices lifting as one can make a chorus that sings a mighty song.
So Norbert and I actually have talked about this before. We had at the Indiana Authors Award. Yeah. We had, and you know, it occurred to me after that conversation several years ago that I missed what would have been a good question to present. So I'm glad I've got the second opportunity here, which is out of this. You know, a large part of what we think of in life is trying to integrate the pieces of our lives, all
Absolutely.
These disparate moments and all of that. How is it that the writing of these poems allowed you to own your own experience?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you're talking about integration. These poems in this book came in four voices: the boy I was, the man I became, an imagined character named Mr. Blues, based on the mm-hmm. 50 years of my loving the Delta Blues and listening mm-hmm. to it, and he's a healer. And then at the suggestion of my therapist, after I had already written 275 poems, the voice of the priest who was my abuser. And I didn't want to do it at first. I thought that would be abusive. But those are all the parts of myself, and they talk mm-hmm. to one another, and it mm-hmm. pulls it all together. So that's the integration part of the question. But what was the rest of your question?
Well, it was really how you were able to own your own experience then. Not just because there's a power in that,
yeah,
I would
there's
think,
a real
too.
Power in owning there your is. Experience and bringing it out and sharing it and putting it out in the public, because then other people hear it and they can do the same for their whole experiences, mm-hmm. you know. I think that's I remember getting an email from a woman writer in Indianapolis, and she was at the book launch at the Interfaith mm-hmm. Center, Interchurch Center, and she said, "Thank you for giving me the terms to speak about my abuse."
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. That's beautiful. I got so many. I was mm-hmm. really worried about going public with this because when it came out in 2014, people were sick, especially Catholics, of hearing about abuse in the church and mm-hmm. didn't want to hear anymore. But I was really moved by the positive responses. Relieved, actually.
Well, and if I can just jump in for one minute, Norbert and I, what brought us together was I read Catholic Boy Blues, and my ex-husband is a pastor. Mm-hmm. And so the religious imagery that is in Norbert's book spoke to me so powerfully and made me realize I'm not alone.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm not alone. Mm-hmm.
That's what great, good poetry can do, is make us realize mm-hmm. we're not alone.
Yes.
So, Manon, I hate to say it, you're up now.
So, and today is actually World Poetry Day.
Yes.
Right. So this day is so beautifully befitting to just be here. And it's also actually the death anniversary of a young woman who I wrote this next poem for. This poem is called Requiem for Rekia. And Rekia Boyd was a 22-year-old African-American woman who was gunned down on the South Side of Chicago. So she was actually murdered by an off-duty officer, and the prosecutors actually asked for the charges of involuntary manslaughter. And the judge let the officer go because he said, actually, you should have asked for first-degree murder. And so because the charges were so low, he actually just let the officer go. Yeah, I mean, so this case, it's, and so, I mean, it's really, really heartbreaking. And I wrote this in tribute to her life and all of the, you know, black, you know, boys and girls, you know, who become murdered. And then they become sort of these martyrs that they never asked to be. So that's what it's about. This is Requiem for Rekia. Rekia, had we known that your life would be an open letter added as an epistle to the thick black folded Bibles we carry along with us from sanctuary to cemetery, folded corner pages thumbed through with tenderness and tenuousness, held with hands that will wrinkle with time and tremor, tongues that will sip tears as crimson communion and feast on this bread of sorrows. That this kind of supper would never be the last, that there would be mouths that will pray and never tire of saying your name, Rekia, Rekia, poured in the unwanted cup of Gethsemane's garden, we would have asked, Lord, if it be thy will, let this one not be taken from us. Had we known that you would go before your mother and father and brother and sisters of streets and struggle, that we would follow you like disciples destined to be left deciphering the prophecy of your death, that we would stand at the foot of your cross and cry, Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? That we would be weary in disbelief and ask to put our hands in the bullet holes from which you bled and were crucified before this empire of ignoble soldiers in black and blue attire, that we would whisper your name in monasteries of sainthood and the sacred scrolls roll too soon, that after 3 days and three nights we would visit your tomb only to not find you there. Had we known that your name would be added to our holidays of mourn, of sackcloth and ashes and ancestors, had we known, we might have told you that we hadn't wanted you as martyr, but only as magical black girl. We hadn't wanted you as saint and sacrifice, but only as our sister. We wouldn't have rushed you through hopscotch and hula hoops from barrettes to training bras too soon now. Rekia, had we known, we would have never prepared you for a world that asks you to be a strong black woman. We would have just asked that you be.
Bravo.
So that's a, And I want you to talk briefly because I do want to allow time for Devin here. Yeah. You know, what struck me is the, as I was listening to that, is the power of bearing witness.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Well put.
What that meant to you as you were writing the poem.
Yeah, I felt in it, you know.
Yeah.
Like I felt very much in it, and I was, and I remember looking at the story, and I was, and I was reading articles, I was looking at case evidence, and I felt that this young black girl could have been me, or could have been any of my friends, or any one of us, and so I put myself inside of this experience to give this tribute. Of saying that you were here, and that your life meant something.
It mattered.
Yes,
it mattered. Devin, we're getting a little close on time, so I'm going to ask you to pick a shorter piece, if possible.
Yeah, sure thing. And I can be super brief with this. So to preface, this poem was composed after being asked to sit on a roundtable discussion called Erased from the History of Resistance. It featured poets Tatiana Rebell and L. Roberts, and we discussed the pivotal roles Bayard Rustin, Audre Lorde, and Marsha P. Johnson played in the pursuit of justice, and how those folks have influenced our lives. And as a queer poet of color, I always felt that it was imperative for me to have my Stonewall poem. And I've never written one, but I was moved to do that. So just to preface with a content warning, this poem contains notes on Black death, transmisogyny, implied suicide, and police brutality. And while the poem has some strong language, it's formatted for public radio. So this poem is dedicated to all Black trans lives lost to bigotry and violence. It's titled Pay It No Mind. 1945 in Elizabeth, New Jersey, a queen established her monarchy where sovereignty was ignored and her full self destined to be misnamed before she had a name that was never her name. It was a shot glass first. But some say it was a rock. Some say a brick. Some say it was a bottle sitting, sipped, splashed, shattered the reveal. What matters is that people saw. People could recount the moment St. Marcia decided a queen needed space amongst the need for space in a space with no space, a life lived in a vacuum full of holy flowers hiding in back seats and blacked out bars, flowing with watered down sanctioned libation, blurry and vivid, stone and wall. Glitter and gin spilled on the alleyways and the boulevards that link to a set of villages comprised of a set of systems rooted in closeted white supremacist patriarchal capitalism on Christopher Street. But if we're being honest, we know that Mama would say it's just another Saturday, honey, and the swine, ever present and anti-Black, cuffing to shackle, knocking to break, snatching, lynched, pearls, clutched when the sun went to sleep. The public moral squad would gather a stacked assortment of pawns and knights on the strip to ensure the queens can be checked. Marcia can't be checked. She said checkmate when she said justice and power to the people, darling, before making it her home. En route to New York from Jersey, an egg cracked on a train to reveal a caterpillar with a dead name, carrying burning clothes fit for a funeral, enveloped herself piece by piece in chrysalis spun from marvelous silk, arriving to the Big Apple donning apismatic color warnings fit for a riot, darling. She was a painted lady, a butterfly, family, Nymphalidae, genus, Vanessa, type, bug, pattern and coloring, hot peaches. Diet? Omnivore, like, eat what's in front of you no matter how putrid. Clean that carcass. This strut requires strength. Wingspan? 5 to 9 centimeters. Small enough to be overlooked. Bold enough to be a target in the face of practice. Average lifespan in the wild? No data. Which is to say, if a monarch's wings get wet, she is likely to have drowned. Which is to say she may have been bludgeoned and submerged. Her star children wore her crown while they identified the butterfly floating against the current of the Hudson River. The painted lady whose wings got wet. Marcia Pay It No Mind Johnson. They pulled her body from the water when I was just a baby and the case is still cold. Tight-lipped public servants, it's okay. The streets know the kind that stole Black Marcia's spirit from her bones.
And I am afraid that will have to be the last word. I would like to thank my guest, Norbert Kropp, Devin Ginn, Manon Voice, and Wendy Vergoes for a wonderful examination of poetry and its power. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producers, Sarah Neal Estes, Roxana Caldwell, and Jill Sheridan. Interactive Media Coordinator, Scott McAllister. Technical Producers, Cedric Freeman and Chris Flood. And Board Engineer, Joe Hatcher. Emily Matheny screens our calls. No Limits is made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.